starting a public order practice?
You know, in all instances, I think you would have to assume, first of all, that people will not really believe when we're talking about delegating authority as well as responsibility. In all instances, we have to assume that they will disbelieve that. But we have found, without exception, at the point at which they realize you're talking about real things, you're talking about really allowing them to have a handle on their own future, that people overwhelmingly respond in a positive way. That is, if they have a board of people elected in an advisory status at that time who were only elected on the basis that they were the ones in the community who were willing to give their time to a non-entity such as an advisory school board whose advice didn't have to be listened to, then if they realize all of a sudden we're going to have a real board and they're going to do real things, then they hastily re-elect and put higher status people in the community, real leaders. In other words, it's a question of local resources. You have in many of the smaller villages particularly three or four or six leaders who would, when high priority, really important things come to the village, those people then are funneled, you know, funneled their efforts into them. At this point in time, you know, you got land claims, elections, and corporations springing up and investments, and you know, all these other considerations that are generally consuming the efforts of these high status people, you know, the real village leaders. But in places where it's perceived that, you know, school board is going to be a real function now, and this has importance for their children, therefore their futures, that these are the kind of people that inevitably gravitate to the board.
In response to that same question, I'm afraid those who have heard me on this subject before may get a little wary of it, but we have, over the last 3 years, been developing a demonstration school that's completely outside any of the normal structure to learn the means, the way by which people in a village go about making their own decisions. One of the very first problems that they encountered was the decision of where to place their building. Incidentally, this came from, you know, they didn't even have to fight for budget considerations at all. It was a foundation buying the building, but with all control vested in a 13-man school board. And incidentally, the 13-man school board was contrary to what an advisory board is in number, only because the traditional community communication scheme required the involvement of certain segments of the community that the residents knew that someone from outside would not know. But this 13-member board even refused to accept the decision-making process as to where to put their building, always under the excuse that someone eventually will come out from Ancaster Juneau and tell us where to put it. Well, no one would make the decision, and it was not made until a helicopter literally was placing it into the village. And it became a real thing. And then where are you going to put it? And the decision was made. But since then, it's taken 2 years to get it to where it is now, where there is an active program. The type of program is just marvelous to hear about, the things that are going on. But there are things that they have done without this other kind of influence. The answer to your question from that place is clearly they knew what they wanted in the way of an education program.
I think I'd like to use another example, Elaine, and jump all over me since it's her hometown. When I lived there for a year and a half, it was really my feeling that although the Yakutat had school powers and had local control of schools, the school board did not control the school. My experience there was the school administrator controlled it at that time very often, and the board often tried to fight, at times really tried to fight with the administrator, and often was very unsuccessful because he, of course, was sure of his ground. He was an education specialist. Once he was just a music teacher, really, but anyway, he thought he knew what the hell he was doing. And often the administrators ran the school board, and at least I think in the areas where you might end up initially with weak school boards, probably what you're going to have is a school run by a principal or administrator, which is not much different from the system that's set up now with the school board giving advice to people. But what did happen in that was after a while they grappled with the problem, and I think they got it. They got a more One thing they did was get a more sensitive administrator, finally, who did listen to what the community wanted. And although I'm not as close to her as I used to be, I see now where the school board is really influencing what's going on. So it seems to me that what you're going to find is that very often school boards, when they take over, are going to stumble along. And they're not going to always know. And there always is going to be the danger that administrators or principals will run the school. But also, I think most of the experience in showed that after a while, when people have the opportunity, and it may take some serious issue, you know, at Maverick and Yakutat, it was a guy that was completely incompetent. I think that finally aroused the community so much that they really decided to put some effort into the school. Fired one of the guys, and he burned down a trailer. It's just incredible. They did deal with it, and I think you will find that that's what, you know, that kind of thing will repeat itself.
All right, John, I was school board president for 5 years.
That was before I got there.
And I was wrestling with the same problems.
I think Frank's example of, you know, the helicopter lowering the building on site is really the graphic portrayal of the problem. Until, you know, the helicopter is actually hovering overhead and people can really perceive that it is indeed going to lower, then, you know, everybody really has difficulty getting excited about making a decision. In fact, I think experience would indicate, you know, more often than not, the state has actually touched ground with the building only to, you know, take off again. You know, it's done that at Nulato and Galena and Barrow again and again and again, Nelson Island and high schools, you know. These people, how long has it been in the discussion stage at Galena? You know, it's there again with the state and the BIA. But somehow, you know, we have to set our intentions in concrete to really have good intentions, and then somehow the burden is on us, on the legislators, to communicate to the people that this really is a solid thing we're offering, and this is not just more pie in the sky.
Chairman, I'd like to ask Frank how it's working up there in terms of purchasing supplies and providing transportation for those kids who may live some distance away from the village, hiring, firing teachers,
well,
all
course,
those things.
That school doesn't have certified teachers other than those who volunteer their time, and there is no transportation problem. It is a local, it's a small village. And I would say that as far as providing instruction and such in the what they call the learning center, so as to not confuse it with the school. It's become very interesting to see the kind of program and the people who do the teaching. Because sometimes people will come out from Fairbanks to help them and teach them ceramics. Since they have clay nearby, they decide they had to have a kiln, so they're making things of that nature. And they need an outside instruction. On the other hand, those things that would pertain to their local museum or what have you, people within the community become the teachers. So it's not a fair parallel in all regards. They're not taking care of what you would call the traditional basic learning.
Mr. Chairman, my question really, again, is under option number one. How would it work out, actually, if every village had to have all those things on its own? What would the cost be to the state?
I suspect, I don't know if that. You could, I think, from my point of view, one of the problems would be that the state obviously has a great advantage in bulk buying that you don't throw out the window. But in terms of personnel expense, I'm not sure that you're talking about any more money. And one could probably even make the case that you're talking about less. If you've got a principal and you've got a school, that's what the village controls. And they will be allotted a certain amount of money, and that's what will run the school.
Well, I hope all those details will be explored then, right now.
I think that, it seems to me that that's one of the issues that both the department and SOS are best qualified to look at. I think that you raise a good point. It's possible that you're going to sacrifice some things in going into that process. You could also look at some special services that I guess used to be provided more by the state than they are now. You should have, I recall, those services that you don't have anymore. And some of that responsibility might be a state responsibility for all school districts. It's anxious for the math and check.
Right. But somebody will have to weigh those and balance out the advantages against the disadvantages, which is the responsibility. It may be worth $20 million extra dollars per year, actually, just to do that.
You had local control, and the local control tended to hire the personnel from the area we were going to move around. I think one of the expenses, or one of the possible expenses, has been personnel not staying in the outlying areas. But if you hired personnel who were going to remain in the region, please, that in the long term you might save money.
Probably the reverse is true, that the longer people stay, the more money they cost. Because the rate increases, longevity is actually expensive.
Yeah, but I think we get longevity now, but what we get is that it's a longevity within the SOS system, where
right.
A person stops in the nap, starts in the nap, and stops.
Plus, since all those people are regarded as not being residents of the community, they get traveled to and from point of departure, like Anchorage or Fairbanks,
And under SOS, they know they can move around. Whereas if you're hired by Nevada School District, and that's who your contract is. That if you've got a commitment to a school district, it's to that one, and you know you've got to make the commitment. Now, you may, this teacher may, that's not going to prevent teachers from moving. But I think if you do get it, perhaps a greater community commitment.
I'd like to ask Frank another question. In relation to your pilot village, or the one that has made this transition, how long then did it take for them to make the transition to where they can make their own decisions and develop this unique, very good program for them? What auxiliary help is still being given to them? What was given at the time and what is still being given?
Yeah, well, the whole program is auxiliary, really, because the school, the SOS school continues. So it's more a demonstration of how people become involved in the program. But the support has been, it's like, I guess, so many programs of that nature. It has cost very, very little. But it's cost little because it has had the enthusiasm of the people who are involved in it. And a cost comparison is probably an unfair thing, because once the newness idea of it wears off, and once there would have to be staff people paid to operate the school, these would obviously go up. On the other hand, the mere fact that there is a lot of instruction and a lot of activity in the school that people are encouraged or enthused to do just on their own initiative because it relates to their interest could very well continue. This is, again, where you get to this point that Dennis made in his paper, the considerations, special considerations of this type of environment as compared to a traditional kind of school district. We don't know the way people are going to respond to local involvement, and many services might come from within that you normally pay for in Anchorage. It's very difficult to really compare. All of the support thus far has come from three foundations, a little bit of seed money that we've put into it, and one grant from the State Department of Education to buy equipment for the building. But I would say over the total cost of 3 years, it has cost about $60,000 or $70,000 total, including the construction of the building.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I answered my question. Okay. I think my question is the type of auxiliary help, not the cost. I'm not even worried about that.
Yeah.
I am worried about that, but that is the question. Yeah. I'm wondering what kind of help was needed to make them aware of what they could do.
Oh.
How long did it take, and what
kind
of ongoing help?
It comes back to the point Judy Kleinfeld made this morning. There were a couple of inspired teachers. Those teachers became a part of the community. They're building homes there. They've married into the community. But they, in turn, had an opportunity to go out on the world for a year, and they went around sampling demonstration programs elsewhere, learned about them, took them back, and had the initiative to at least acquaint the people in the village with what the potential was. Then the people picked it up. But, yeah, the catalyst was there. The catalyst was a creative pair of teachers. And since then, they've continued to be the driving force in it, in partnership with the school board. And it really has required a partnership. They've acquired insight into the needs because it is their community. Again, I think a little bit of what Betty was maybe suggesting, too. If people move to the communities and become part of it, they have a different idea of what the teaching job is than if they're transients for years.
But what we're really seeing is we can't go number one unless we have this catalytic movement of some sort, a very well-planned, organized catalytic movement.
Certainly would appear that that's been essential to date, yes.
I think we should note that Commissioner Malott has just arrived.
Okay. Byron, do you want to get into the table so you get the fray? All questions are addressed to your issues.
Can I sit up there?
Yes, please.
John? I wonder if the same principle would not then apply to the existing school districts. And I think if it's fitting as an educational design, that it would be fitting for Girdwood and for Chester Valley and for Eagle River. And I'm serious about this. Because very many cases, those people feel isolated from the people who decide about what happens in schools. And if you're going to fragment it, well, let's fragment it all the way through and do it with thought and perception as to the kind of programs that you're going to fund in those various communities. Now, I'm looking forward to the revenues from the pipeline almost gleefully now because I think I think this will help, you see. I had reload, and it might take some more money. I think, though, it'll bring a lot of schools closer to their communities than they currently are.
I really think you're at a good point that it's an issue that the legislature just decided to go on a route like this, then I think they have to address the issues of those communities that are in organized boroughs now, right? And given the education responsibility of the borough.
Mr. Chair, the total incentive for creating this sort of thing is certainly not isolated to the rural areas. And I point out that some of the ideas that inspired these two teachers, they observed in the British primary schools, in the open school concepts there, that are actually being, in part, played there. And once you embark upon this, though, it becomes a much more dangerous or difficult thing to implement for the simple reason that the vast majority of teachers presently practicing aren't trained along these lines either. You open up a whole other aspect of the problem. I think the work that the SOS has been doing, I mean, probably that point alone is one that has caused them concern. I've heard Lyle mentioning this, that when you talk about the freedom that local control entails, you're dependent a great deal on more creative teachers who are attuned to that surrounding. And the whole business of preparing teachers for these assignments, it broadens that as a problem extensively.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make one point here. I think that we have been talking about people educating second-class citizens, and I think we have people right in the Anchorage borough that are being educated as second-class citizens.
That's my point, exactly.
And I hope that out of this, I think special education, when it came into being, made a much better program of regular education if they accepted some of this. And what I'm sincerely hoping is that if we can solve our rural problems, it's going to be the urban problems to an extent where we are treating people as second-class.
My real point, Helen, was that there's no isolation. I mean, everybody's in this canoe about improving the quality.
That's beside the point. We have such a big right now with the rural, but I think it's going to help the other as well.
We're going to get through all nine of these this afternoon and we're discussing, but we have brought up issues that relate not just to obviously the local school, but relate to some of the other. But before we do that, I'd like to take about a 5-minute break.
And John, we do have tomorrow morning on the list as well.
Oh, okay, well. Who needs an SOS proposal?
Yeah, I need to be here. You're staying in the building.
Very interesting, Pat, about the Navajo.
Okay, I'd like to get going again. Next option that's been raised is the option of regional school systems. Dennis, do you want to make some comments on what you're talking
about? Mr. Chairman, I think I'll use the board in going over this one.
I think I might comment while Dennis is moving up the board that we now have three representatives of the architectures.
Probably dominate the meeting now, won't they?
John, you might point out, too, that during the course of the afternoon, Annie Brower joined us as a sit-in for Joe Upton. Oh, there she is. She's here for the North Slope.
And Sam Pito wandered in also.
You want me to say it publicly or privately, John?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, there are about half of the states have some form of regionalization for educational services. And this is an intermediate level between the state and the local level, primarily for delivering educational services to the local community. We've looked at a couple of different models that we've been able to find in the literature available. These are not too clearly defined as to how they operate, but they at least give us some idea of what is available, what's been tried, and some idea of what's happening in those two different approaches. And I'd like to refer now to the areas of local control that were cited earlier this morning, that is the policy, operational policy, personnel, curriculum, and finance. And I'd like to develop a matrix on the board in which we also show different levels of which control is now exercised. Now we have the federal level with the funding, the state level, and the state, there are two there are two different entities that we have to take into account. One is the Department of Education and the other is SOS. And then we have local with the regional concept. There are two approaches to developing a region, and I think that there have been some questions raised that we haven't answered, but we've not found the answer yet for in regard to whether or not you can develop this approach. We've not found any reason you can't, so it seems possible that you can. One model is for the regional area to somehow incorporate in some area of Alaska or in the different areas all of the unorganized boroughs to regionalize in some way, and then within that region to elect representatives to a regional board. And that region would have certain prerogatives in regard to educational services, and there can also be some that are exercised at a local level, so there could be some division there. And in this model, the power flows in that direction. The state has more control in the region than the local. This is one model. Another one is one in which the order is reversed, in which case the state mandates local control, and then the local incorporates the region, the local boards in a region incorporate and create a regional council of some sort, a regional board. And in this case, the power would go that way, and the regional then would respond to the local. One of the advantages that there would be in this form is that it can possibly take into account an issue that was raised in previous meetings, and that's the issue of one man, one vote. To create this kind of a regional corporation, there's an intermediate level of government here with all of the electorate voting for that board. The concept of one man, one vote seems to be operative, in which case a region with one large community can conceivably control all of the small surrounding communities. And this is a problem that was raised in the previous meetings and some that I think a lot of you are already familiar with. One option now, and we need to study this further, is the possibility of the state allowing the locals to create regionals in which they may appoint or in some other manner select the regional board so that the one man, one vote concept is not such a problem in establishing that, so that there is representation from all of the community.
Well, Dennis, the state could mandate. I mean, it seems to me either way they could provide, if they set up regions, that there would be some representative from each school board on it, even though maybe all the electorate would vote on it in the whole region, or maybe
right.
It wouldn't be that way. So I think you can get that no matter which way you go. It may be a little easier the second way, but there's still nothing to do.
With that kind of approach, then you have to factor in a way to vote as well. You still do have the problem, or at least as far as we've been able to see, there still is that problem with the one man, one vote. It would still be the control in the larger community, even if you were able to get representation from the smaller communities as well.
I think that might be a little premature if you don't go and to the villages that and ascertain from a number of these villages that would be put into this situation and see what they felt in regards to this being offensive to them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in response to that, I'd like to make reference to some of the discussion this morning that I think that you missed. What we're trying to do at this point is divide the discussion into two parts. One part would be discussion of the feasibility of the different options that are available, at which time we'd like to get some professional assessment of the feasibility of these different options. And then another part that we'd like to build into this is a consideration of the desirability of these different options, at which time we'd like to get a client assessment as well of these different options. So in looking at this now, what we're trying to identify is whether or not it is feasible, whether it can operate. And then there's another question we'd like to ask. Would it be acceptable to the
this is just one
areas
of
that, are,
we're talking
that are affected?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this question is prompted by the fact that I remember when we were talking about service areas, and some of us had sort of a rough idea what villages should fall within a service area, and we were told that some of those village groups would not want to be in the same service area. And so my question is relating back to this. If we talk about the local going back to the region, would they be determining what the region is or the advisory board that would be within a region which is already set?
So if you do the second way, that the local people, when they get together, decide, you know,
they decide on the region and the advisory
board. That we want to form the region. One of the villages didn't want to form it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to back up a little bit. I left out a portion in considering the previous option, and that's that in looking at these, one way we can look at them, one way we're trying to look at them, and one way we can factor in the discussions now is to ask several questions that seem to apply. And one is, what are the advantages of the option under discussion? What are the disadvantages? And then, what are the kinds of problems that you see that we need to take into account? And I think that the reference that you just made is one that definitely has to be taken into account in legislating any kind of a regional corporation that is a real problem. And if there are any other problems that can be seen in either of these, this is not a model that's set for legislation at all, but it's set here just to raise questions such as that.
Is there any questions?
Once again, I think we'd need to raise the question of what kind of criteria would be used to compare the ability of the region or the local communities. What type of criteria will we create to measure the communities against in order to establish their school boards, handle their education? Another is, we mentioned in the other, do we provide within that some type of a system for them to make a change, or a procedure for them to make a change in the future if they see fit, as long as we're making a local action? What kind of criteria would we establish even for a regional service area?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there are some questions such as that, I think, that do apply to probably all of the options that we have. In some of the questions that have been raised in our discussion, some of them are specific to one or two or three of the options, and some of them apply to all. And I think that one that you've raised does apply to all of the
Here's another one. I realize it applies to another one back here too, but voluntary or mandatory, no, that's before first class. When we start going through the process of determining the desirability of it, are we going to make it mandatory that within a certain length of time all of these areas form into some sort of an education service district, be it a local school board or a regional school board? And if so, how much time, what time frame would would be best, most workable for setting in a mandated date such as May, would it be 1990 or 1980 or 1975 or 1984? 1772. It might be that we would need to write this into legislation. I don't know.
Well, it seems to me that the caller, what you've raised, is the issue of assuming that there's some option or you're setting criteria for whether or not a local area qualifies under whatever system. You're then saying that there's some other still statewide entity running school systems. I mean, if there's an option, it's not mandatory, and you're saying, well, some can if they meet certain criteria, but others that don't, then they have to be under some system. So I assume you're...
Well, you'd bet. It would appear that you'd have to have some interim body functioning while this was going on, which is what SOS does. But then you would have criteria set up for, I would assume, local communities and for regional groups. So if they wouldn't meet the criteria for a local, then it would be their option as to what sort of regional, what villages within that area would want to go into a regional thing, and then give them a time frame within which they meet the criteria of one or the other. And then way you're giving a date for an excellent place
off. I'd be worried about setting criteria because I think that Native people are really unpredictable. One of the...
They're no different, you know that. Huh? They're no different from some others.
Well, but that some are especially, you know. One of the interesting things that happened about 3 years ago with the Cree Indians in Canada, they came to these decision-making junctures, and they were going to think, well, are they going to, go along with the school systems? What they decided to do was just completely move out of the area into the Northwest Territory and give up totally speaking anything but Cree. And they just went back to the blanket, as the term goes. You know, that's kind of an interesting alternative. Maybe everybody's going to be deciding to go the way this model school, this demonstration school. You know, who knows what really is going to happen if we set a rigid criteria. It might be that there would be some surprises.
Okay. Well, the Crees that you were talking about were utilizing their option, which I feel that we should keep into our system, as even we now have it with our Foundation Act, be very flexible. I think we should provide for these options, but I also feel that we're going to have to set some sort of a time limit. We're going to have to set some sort of a criteria for what type of educational system they would qualify for, or we'd have no idea in the world how to project the fiscal aspect of it.
I think that also,
and since heat generated by the controversy surrounding, but it seemed like whenever we mold anything in clay in this system, it all somehow gets baked and hardens, you know, and we can build it with flexibility and options, but somehow it all has a way of turning to crystal.
Well, it's the people themselves that do it.
Defining
the
people as
everybody.
I don't know what.
John.
All of us.
Yeah. I think we have one consideration here that maybe needs to be brought up, and that is, let me just give an illustration. You have a local school district, let me say at Eagle, and in this particular local school district, you have two deaf children. You see. Now, it might not be feasible for the two teachers in Eagle to provide special services for those children. And they say, well, we don't have anyone competent right on our staff with the two people we have to take care of this. So we need to get, or be able to get, some special help. Now, are you going to have special services available at a regional level? That's one factor. The second factor is a little more compelling, and that is, are you going to say that the local district has to utilize those facilities for the two deaf children? Or is it an optional thing with the local district, and they can say, well, those deaf kids, they're a lot of trouble around here anyhow, so we won't provide the services, you see, or we won't require the local school district to provide those services. I mean, these are the kinds of questions that you run into on a functional basis. Are you going to mandate that the local district has to contract, or are you going to say the local district has a free hand to contract.
John, when someone's preparing these papers for the options that will be available, there are only three, I think, maybe four, special education projects in the lower 48, one at Rosebud, one at Crow, and one at Navajo, and the one at Navajo is the exemplary one. And whoever it is that's preparing the background for this, for the decision-making, might look into those and write, see what they did about it.
Any other comments on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think the federal law demands that you give educational opportunities to all kids, no matter what their condition. So this would not be something the state could even set. This would be set by federal law, at least.
Well, I'd be interested in finding the statute, the way that says that it's required by federal law. I doubt that it. It might under civil rights, but not under a specific statute.
You don't think it's required by civil law?
I doubt if it is.
I mean, by
civil rights laws.
Yes.
I realize it is. Yeah.
Part under that New Orleans decision in June, federal district court New Orleans, June 1st, last June.
Any other comments on resources?
Mr. Chairman, is there any reason to presume that in setting up a regional situation that the people involved would be willing to follow the geographic lines of the present 12 Native corporations?
As we discussed earlier, it seems to me that you're not going to do much crossing of those lines. You may end up in some areas where you have school districts, if you're going to have a regional concept, where, say, in the Bethel area, where there are 55 villages, where you might have that region broken up into several different districts. But so I don't know whether you get, say, exactly 12. Well, also, one of the regional corporations right now covers all the places that are already in existing boroughs. So, that's that. So I don't know how you answer. You know, I don't know how you answer that question. But I think it depends on how the legislation is written. If the state deems that large regions are the best, and you want a minimal amount, then I think regional corporation lines are probably good ones. If you're going to go somewhat smaller, you're going to have another problem.
If I could follow up on that. How then do you overcome this problem that has already been raised, and I'm sure there are others than this one, of the larger populated community dominating the entire regional board?
It depends on how the region is set up. If you set up a say Kotzebue, just use the Nana region, it's quite conceivable Kotzebue can control that whole group. Unless you write something in the legislation, there's no protection.
We've lived with that argument in Anchorage for years. Even Reverend Chubiak claims that the downtown schools that get all the services from the family. I don't know how legitimate their claim is, but.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to note the subcategories in the matrix of the operational curriculum, planning, and personnel as a potential way of making sure that a local, a small unit doesn't get dominated by a larger unit within the same region, so that you can guarantee that only certain functions are under regional control, and others are left, such as operational curriculum or curriculum and personnel, are left very low,
the
smallest unit, so that can be
brought to Mr. Chairman, the kinds of functions that has been identified for the regional are mainly business management and support services, the delivery of support services to the schools in that area. And how well we might make that division is, I don't know yet. On the other hand, the other consideration is the educational aspect of such a school system. And the question now is, can the local districts exercise local control in those different categories in regard to the educational services? And can they give to the regionals the business administration and the support service functions? I think that pretty much is the idea of regionalization. There's some real advantage there in developing some size.
I don't understand, you know, why we should really address ourselves to protecting within the presentation that's being made for the smaller schools, you know, smaller communities. I think, you know, we already have a beginning of an operational borough system on the North Slope where all their members are elected, you know, and they're elected from throughout the borough, you know, and it's operational, you know, and here we sit trying to figure out checks and balances and corrections of, you know, something that may not even be there.
Well, he confused me. Well, I'll get back to that later. I was wanting to ask Dennis, when you're talking about support services and business management for the regional board, how are you going to... Now, a part of the business management, of course, is the finance part. But that also covers personnel, right? So then your local school boards wouldn't be involved in... training and hiring and so forth of teachers. That's part of business management, it's personnel. How are you going to divide it out because it's the finances that are paying personnel salary?
Well,
when you come to curriculum, how are you going to divide that out because it's your curriculum that costs money and you provide the curriculum you can afford?
At the regional level, you can set decisions that, you know, school is going to have X number of dollars, and out of that, you can make decisions. You're going to hire, you know, five teachers, or you're going to hire three professional teachers and four aides, and you're going to teach bilingual, or you're going to just, you know, if you know what your budget guideline is out of region, then you still have the flexibility to make those other decisions.
Then it'll be limited business management.
Well, the,
just
the division,
out the pot among
the division will have to be arbitrary somehow within the region as to how they'll divide those functions. But in regard to personnel, for instance, a local can say, this is the kind of person that we want teaching in our school district. They can set up that kind of criteria. And that does relate to the educational policy of the school. And then, on the other hand, the...
One final question. And do you envision the local boards within the region as being advisory to the regional board?
No.
Actually, they would be actual... operational policy establishment board.
That's one thing that
with their own
happen.
Budget turned over to them from the regional.
That's one option.
Well,
okay,
that's
the other option is that they are as, you play the, probably the same kind of options we have in our present system and the regional system.
That's one way of doing it.
And that, well, it's not necessarily a decision that has to be made in the legislature. I would think it would be part of the input that we would want to get from when we start. When you go after the desirability, which of these options do people consider the most desirable, as well as feasible and functional?
John, actually, the illustrations that Dennis is making on this, it can really go to the extreme that the regional level is strictly a mechanical thing, meeting the needs of a local district sort of on demand. For example, one computer-based regional system does the entire payroll, does the entire inventory as a service to a small district that doesn't necessarily want to be bogged down in that, but doesn't preempt their local decision-making prerogative. It can go just the opposite to it, as in a sense, almost to the point that large rural boroughs now do. Kenai Peninsula has school boards in each one of the districts, but they certainly only get advice from the local boards, which is not unlike this. As Wayne was pointing out, Seward used to have a school board. Now they have an advisory board.
Well, would we want to define what type of operation that should be within the legislation? That's another question that should be raised.
Yeah. Or to what extent should it be defined?
As I see it, either one of these approaches could have the flexibility that would make for a good vehicle if it was not, you know, cast in concrete at the earliest. I see where the approach of the state to the regional and then to the local might be a little more structured than if perhaps the state supported, gave the support services to the local. The local came up with what they wanted and came back up and devised the regional in whatever manner they were going to do it. It would seem to me that'd be more grassroots. But if you had the right type of support within the middle area, the regional area, they could do the same thing. They could get the support from the grassroots to bring it back up. Either way, it could be work beautifully depending on your people and the philosophy that they go into.
It strikes me that the latter is actually what an SOS is presently doing.
It is.
It also seems to be my impression in most instances where government is moving from the top down
it's less effective than if it's moving from the bottom up. So if it went from the state to the local, and then the locals got together and created their regional board to handle the payroll and stuff.
And give them just as much as they want.
Yeah. I think what it does is faces the question whether or not they really think that there are real advantages to the regional concept, because it's quite conceivable if you do it that route that maybe most or all the locals will say we don't want any. So it's an issue Pat raised with the Navajos. And so
if the locals have created the region, then it's quite different if the region created the locals.
That's right. But all I'm saying is if you leave them the option, you have to live with the fact that they may not form any regions at all. No. Or that they may form them and bust them up the first time as individual school districts have them.
Problem, yeah.
Anything else on regions? The next option is contract with Native corporations. I'd like to make a couple just preliminary remarks. Sam and Al's might want to follow up. It relates to something that Senator Thomas said earlier today, something Pat said. I think to understand the Land Claims Act, you have to understand several things. First of all, there is no intent anywhere in the Act that the regional corporation set up will use their money to fund education, health, or social service. And although it's been referred to earlier today as great wealth, because of the way the money comes in the bill, even by the best estimates in the Senate, it will take at least 30 years. That's given the pipeline actually having already been built to get all our money. And now may take even longer than 30 years. So you're talking about money spread out. And actually, if you do the figures and find that if the Native corporations just had to take over the DIA and public health service functions, they'd all be bankrupt in about 15 to 20 years. The land claims is not an immediate solution to the state problem of trying to deliver the services mandated to it by Constitution. The Native corporations are specified in the bill as being profit-making corporations and really legally have no more obligations to pick up social services and education than General Motors does for Detroit or Hickel Investment Company does for Anchorage. They do, however, have all the regular corporate responsibilities of paying taxes and the other kinds of things that corporations do. And I think the long-term benefits are that corporations work. They will develop businesses and economic bases that will pay taxes to provide these services. But I just think it's dangerous for the state to look at the land claim. Not dangerous. I think it's just not going to work because it will be determined to be illegal. The state looks to the regional corporations for funding all the things that they see need to be done in rural areas. And I know the Speaker of the House, among others, definitely said that we should cut back on rural expenditures because of the land claims. And I just think that's a major mistake. I think you're also finding that the regional corporations, and AFN, as a matter of fact, the regional corporations actually have, in the process of making a definite distinction between land claims, corporations, and social services. Most of the regional corporations now have nonprofit corporations, which do sign contracts with the state and the federal government and other people, but they're not the same thing as the regional profit-making corporation set up under the Act, and it's an optional kind of thing. AFN board has voted that we should divest ourselves of our social programs and deal strictly with land claims. So there's a great difference between what the Act says and what most people in the state think it says, and I think we need to understand that before we start discussing this concept.
Mr. Chairman, this rate, I thought that within the very near future, let's say 6 months, that the $120 million would be delivered to the Native corporation. That's one lump sum. Is that right?
Well, about $120 million of the $962 million will be delivered. Now, of that, the legislation provides the regions themselves keep 45% of that. 10% is automatically distributed to individuals. 45% go into village corporations, which can be profit or non-profit. That money's already split up. The regions have a mandate to split it up as soon as they get it. And then nowhere in the Act are they mandated to spend it on social services or education. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite, particularly with the regions, who have definite responsibilities for their shareholders to be profit-making corporations, the same kind of responsibility that the management of General Motors has for their shareholders.
Well, the Native corporations, as I understand it, do not have the same number of people in every one. Is that right? Some of these tribes have been defunct until this
affair began originally a few years ago. Am I correct about that? In other words,
well, the corporations vary in size anywhere from about 1,000 people to about 13,000, maybe more in the southeast, depending on whether or not there's a corporation outside. But the money is distributed on a per capita basis. It's not divided 12 different ways.
You mean then that each of the native corporations does not get the same?
That's right. Chalista will get almost a quarter of the money, I guess, and Otna will get hardly anything because the money's distributed based on population.
Okay, thank you.
There's three archives.
Yeah, I think one of the things, my suggestion to Willie is going to be that AFM run one or more seminars during the session for legislators and some of the leaders in government in general. The misunderstanding is not just at that level. There's misunderstanding in the native community. There's misunderstanding at the village level. It's a very complicated act. It's certainly the most complicated way yet the U.S. government has found to settle in Indian country. There's a lot of education that needs to be done state.
John,
no,
I think I understand that. But does it mean that whatever boundaries you set for your corporation aren't necessarily the boundaries that would have to be set for any other kind of education or medical?
Oh, yeah, there's nothing that mandates the state follow those corporate boundaries, although, as I've said before, I think it's going to be difficult to get around them because those boundaries have been formed out of groups that have come together in some cohesive political manner and said, we want to be a region. And for most of the areas of the state, the natives represent the majority of the people in the areas we're talking about.
One more question. I presume you know what a frightful duality of government is suffering under an anchor. You have a borough and a city, and they're constantly at one another's throats and having one thing or another. Now, the way I see this possibility is that we're not going to have triple government out in these areas. You'll have the SOS school system, and have some sort of another school system, plus these corporations. And I like to think that this would get melded into one as far as education goes, and have three school boards in every native jurisdiction.
Well, as I said, the corporations themselves are not going to run the education system. Now, there is the possibility that the state, for some reason, may want to contract for certain services with regional corporations. It could be to provide school board training, it could be to provide teacher training, it could even be to provide some of the mechanical kinds of things we've talked about. But the natives are not going to set up their own education system. I think any corporation will tell you that's still the responsibility of the state, and what guidelines the state sets for the education system, the guidelines they live on.
Well, I just want to make clear, speaking for myself alone, I feel the people in those areas involved got to come up with one school board or one educational system irrespective of the pace for it. Otherwise, you're going to have two and possibly three, according to what I've heard around here this morning, this afternoon.
I think that's the whole issue is what we're talking about. What kind of system is this state going to have for providing education to the children?
Just one for each state.
I think I'm going to listen.
John, no. Wouldn't the corporations all have the corporate structure so that the state could contract with them? They could take on the whole mechanism of education. And they, in turn, could recontract with maybe two or three different regions if they want to have a big
school. As I said, it's unlikely that the corporations themselves are going to do that because they're profit-making entities, and no one's yet to show me how you can make money off the education system. It's conceivable that some of the nonprofit corporations may want to do that. I think, my guess is, though, that you're going to have an awful hard time in this legislature. You're going to have people in it, and probably any legislature we have, saying, well, why contract with an all-Native group to provide educational services that go to Natives and non-Natives that the state is funding out of money that cannot be distributed?
Okay, but so it is. Three is not feasible.
Well, it's a possibility, but I really see it as, from my understanding of legislative process, probably the most unrealistic of the many things that are listed.
John, I would like to hear what Dennis has to say on that. When you were making out your list, what was the purpose and why adding the Native Regional Corporation?
The reason for adding all of these were these are approaches that were suggested for bringing local control to the unorganized borough. Whether it in fact does this or not, we hadn't really fully investigated that aspect, which is really the important part of it.
As you traveled throughout the area, to all these areas, what was the view of the people on the road, sort of just your grassroots native people?
In regard to this particular issue? that's an issue that hadn't really come up in any of the in any of the smaller areas that we where we talked with anyone. But that was not really the criteria for selecting it for incorporation into this list. The main reason for incorporating any of these is that they were brought to our attention as options that should be considered for feasibility, and it may not be. I mean, we may come to that kind of a conclusion.
As much to lay some of these things to rest as it is to amplify.
That's right. It's a process of elimination.
Right. Mr.
I was wondering what Byron would say about that. A lot of us don't know anything about this at all, so it's just a matter of hearing that people say who have some expertise in it.
About regional corporations, about contracting or education, and I don't support any kind of expertise. I feel strongly about these issues, largely on a personal basis, that we have some responsibility, obviously, to respond to the issue. One of the questions that's been in my mind since sitting down here is had to do with the number two issue, the regionalization, the service area concept that we talked about, the state contracting for some kind of mechanism. One of the principal issues in my mind is what is that mechanism at the state level that that does what is necessary to see that local control is achieved. I think that's a critical issue. With respect to contracting with Native regional corporations, it's my understanding of Native regional corporations is that that's a reference to the profit-making regional profit-making corporations that were established by the Claims Act. And I think that I would have to agree very strongly with the observations made by Mr. Schley. But even in that area, I think a major question is, what is the instrument at the state level that would contract the regional corporations to function, and what would be the responsibilities of that state agency and the state structure?
There, just in relation to this, there are some potential interesting, I think, possibilities, though, not to wipe it out entirely. I don't think you can run the school system by contracting it out to the Native corporation. I don't, first of all, I don't think the legislature would ever buy it. I'm not sure the corporations would want. But the Native corporations are going to be developing expertise in accounting. Many of them will perhaps have computer systems, accounting systems. They will be recruiting their own personnel. They will be handling sometimes construction companies, other kinds of things that they're going to have to procure for. And it's conceivable on a voluntary basis that districts within the region or local school districts could contract with the region to provide some of those kinds of services, just as they might contract with PMAR, with their Mitchell, or the First National Bank of Anchorage. But that's an area where if the school system bought it, just like if they bought it from any other profit-making corporation, the corporation's profit would be built into the price they charged. It would not be a non-profit kind of business.
I'd like to make one further observation, if I might, on the whole business of Native regional corporations. Also, I mentioned that I do agree with you that the business of directly contracting with profit-making corporations is probably not realistic. That regional corporations are a fact of life, will be a fact of life, and will have an inordinate kind of influence on anything that happens out in the rural areas of our state, and whether or not you contract with them, the way that they establish their relationships with nonprofit structures that they would establish to spin off and pick up on the social service kinds of programs that they have to be responsible to, and responsive to the kinds of relationships that they build with their village corporations, the village profit or non-profit corporations, is something that all decision makers are going to have to plug into their thinking. It's something that I'm very concerned about in the whole context of the development of local government out in the rural areas. And frankly, I have been spending just a lot of time now looking and seeing how the regional corporations shake down, because I think that very process itself is going to influence very, very greatly what happens in the public service and governmental area. And that process obviously isn't finished yet.
Let me see if I've got it clear in my mind. What you're saying is that there is the possibility that the contracts for the native corporations would be related to business services, not educational services.
Mr. Chairman, in looking at these different options, we did find some advantages and disadvantages in different ones, but that didn't keep us from stating them as possible options. And there are a couple of points, two points in particular, that were brought to our attention in this regard that would weigh on the feasibility or infeasibility of this. And one is that in our discussions with the representatives of the regionals, if this could work at all, they are really preoccupied at this time with the land rights legislation and implementation of that, and their priorities are elsewhere. And during the period of time that this is going to be dealt with for quite some time into the future, their priority will be with the implementation of that act. That's one of the factors that weighs against it. And another question that was raised was in regard to entitlement to PL-874 funding. There is PL-874 funding made available now for students that qualify under those provisions. But as I understand it, these funds are made available to public agencies that provide educational services, and the regional corporations are private. And there'd be some question as to whether or not they would qualify for PL-874 funding. So that's one real factor in considering the feasibility of this option. We may, by implementing this kind of an approach, lose that kind of funds.
That is really the strong point that I wanted to make, John, if I can just reiterate again about, you know, education does not really create money as mm-hmm. such, but it does create positions in the administrative overhead. And all of these titles now, I guess the Jackson bill is going to be a new one that's being considered. And when you think of all of those, impact aid, the JOM, the Title I, Title IV, 4A, 3, 7, 10, 8, all of those are going to mean positions and administrative slots and jobs, and it can amount to millions, actually.
Well, I think the important issue there is that that's one of the reasons I think there's been a lot of pressure recently on the issue of local control. Because if the more control you have, if ignoring the fact that it's a native corporation, where you've got communities that are primarily native, the more opportunity they have to employ their own people and set up systems that will train and provide career opportunities.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add to that. I think that is where the money is going to be for a while. Where you have, as far as federal funding goes, is that where you have native local control, there will be funding. And I'd hate to have that not considered, especially with your BIA schools. We have, 53 BIA schools that can be contracted to local control. And we should keep that in mind for the areas that are still, say, under the system of BIA schools.
Anything else on contracting with native corporations? Okay, the fourth option is to organize boroughs and first-class cities, giving two possibilities, one voluntarily and the other mandated. Dennis, do you want to speak to
that? Mr. Chairman, in regard to those two options under that, I'd like to note first that the first option, 4A, is already an available option. The different areas in unorganized borough do have that privilege now to organize as a borough or first-class city. That is, to organize as a borough, at least. And with the first-class city, I think that's 400 residence required. So in regard to the voluntary, that's already in effect. There's been discussion, it's been pointed out, this, that there's been consideration of mandating organization in the unorganized borough, just as there was in about 62 or so for the first boroughs that were created. The one kind of borough that would take care of the educational services is the third class borough, and there's one in existence now in the Haines area, and the powers of a third class borough are in the area of education and taxation. They're pretty limited, but they're oriented primarily to educational services. And so that's the option available there.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that the real issue here is in trying to fit this option into the overall scheme of things is the problems or the questions that are raised as how does education relate to the other aspects of local governments that this implies. And I know that this is the study that Byron's office has been making during the summer and sort of mandated, I guess, Byron. I wonder if it would be inappropriate for this group to be brought up to date on how that is, you know, if you have any conclusions at this time, Byron, or if it is pertinent to what we're talking about.
It wasn't mandated. As a matter of fact, I jumped into that with both feet.
Oh, well, okay.
After sitting through 3/4 of the last legislative session on the sidelines, so, watching the machinations take place with respect to the educational service area bills that were before the legislature at that time. But my department's strong concern was based upon upon a recognized state policy assumption that the provision of educational services at the local level, when you combine that with the issue of local control, is inextricably intertwined with local government. That the provision of educational services is a recognized local governmental function. Had a concern that some of the assumptions that were being made about the provision of educational services and the discussion around the pieces of legislation last year seemed to ignore that constitutional fact of Alaska life, Alaska policy. And it was our concern, based on that, that I think our first real involvement was late in the session with the memorandum that we prepared to Marshall Lynn, laying out the kind of concerns that my department had with what had happened to that point. We are well into the process of a review of all aspects of educational policy for the state, looking at it in terms of that relationship with local governmental policy, with local governmental function, with local governmental structure, trying to look at it both from the local viewpoint and from the state's viewpoint. In terms of letting this group be brought up to date, where we're at specifically is somewhat difficult. We've got at least 5 or 6 staff members working on the project. We're at the point now where we've just about finished with the development of the informational base that we feel necessary to create a common base of facts, definitions of what does exist that impacts the educational service issue, largely because we feel that in a lot of instances, in a lot of the kind of discussions that have taken place during the last several years, that people in many instances have a tendency to talk about apples and oranges. As a matter of fact, a lot of people, frankly, don't know what the hell they're talking about with respect to this issue. We've come to the point in our review, we're looking at it from the narrow viewpoint of the existing statutes, of existing state policy, what is workable, what we see as practical and possible. We've come around to taking a hard look at existing municipal statutes to determine what kind of modification, if any, might allow that vehicle to maximize local control, create a system that is responsive to both the state financial and policy requirements, as well as meeting the gut level local requirements for positive and meaningful input into the educational function. It's in terms of the overall study, we hopefully within a relatively short period of time will have what we feel is a very good statement of the problem as we see it, of the issues that are involved. We will have what we consider a good base of the kinds of information necessary for everybody who has a concern in this area to draw from. We are to the point, for example, where we're working on a slideshow with a script and a narrative that will explain what local government is under our system, where the educational function fits in under present statute, so forth. We are developing a series of brochures that will adequately, we hope, serve to explain the issues as we see them. Frankly, I've been personally concerned ever since the first moment that my department got involved in this, and I guess it's a fact of life that when you deal with an issue and with problems, with structures and responsibilities that presently do exist, in large part it boils down to an issue of what's right and what's wrong based upon whose ox is being pulled. We find that's causing a whole lot of problems. And I think that some of the agencies and the institutions that are involved in this issue are taking that kind of an attitude, and frankly, it causes a whole lot of problems. But commenting specifically on the existing municipal statutes, based upon the work that we've done so far, we frankly feel that mechanism just might work with proper modification, and we don't feel that modification might mean any kind of major surgery either. But in terms of talking specifics, I'm just not able to at this point. For example, the first class city, the population requirement 400 persons is a problem in the creation of first class cities, the creation of a mechanism that responds to meeting the local educational control issue. And we're taking a look at how the third class borough mechanism really functions. Frankly, the third class borough is nothing but a legislatively created educational service area. That's its own function. And we're taking a look at what that mechanism means in terms of the state's local government policy. I guess, you know, that I could probably respond to specific questions.
Mr. Chairman, what does it take for an area to win status as a third class borough? How much land, how many people, what sort of land? Tax base?
The standards are essentially the same, are the same as the location of any borough. And the standards refer to an integrated system in terms of the economy of the region. There are no arbitrary figures in terms of numbers of people. There are no set figures regarding area in terms of land area, and it requires the involvement of the local boundary commission and how it would apply the standards of incorporation which are set out in the statute. But there are no specific and arbitrary kinds of requirements as there are for first class cities.
Are there other reasons than the local tax effort requirement that in your opinion have deterred areas from going this route?
And, well, aside from, I think when people get beyond the first blush kind of aversion to the borough system as a result of what's happening in our urban areas, the problem with the borough system largely is rural people looking at what's happening in Anchorage and Fairbanks and elsewhere. But the problem of a sufficient tax base is the major issue. We've in dealing with North Slope Borough, for example, I don't think that at any point in the proceedings did anybody from the local area have any problems with the structure itself once they got into it. And frankly, in terms of their being able to utilize it to meet the local governmental requirements that they see, we haven't been informed of any problems with the mechanism itself.
What
would happen if the legislature mandated for us, such as there's been reasonably built for nature green tech before we have to address itself to it? Well, I don't know. I think, you know, you'd have all sorts of problems with people spending a lot of time that otherwise they could be really devoting to building a meaningful local government, spending a lot of time castigating the state and all those who are responsible for mandating that the
if we're mandated, they couldn't do it, is what you're saying. They just wouldn't have the tax base to do it unless they eliminated the tax base.
There are certain requirements that would have to be met before anything could function. And without an adequate tax base to perform the kinds of services that local residents felt necessary, you would be creating more problems than you would accomplish, because you would have built a structure that the state had, you know, a recognized kind of obligation to. And they would go back to the state to pay for the services that they had the structure and the responsibility to provide.
Yes. Am I right? Am I understanding you right that you would like to have things stay as they are until you get around to finding out all the things that you're doing your studies on, so that things can move more readily into making structure?
I don't presume that whatever we do is going to be the final answer. We just think that from the review and the work that the department has has done so far, that we frankly, having looked at all of the issues, don't see that big, that large a problem with the municipal mechanisms that presently exist. Now that presupposes a separate state system also, because our thinking is that to mandatorily create systems ultimately breeds more problems than they solve. Really thought through what you've done. And it becomes a local option issue, utilizing the mechanism that does exist with modification as they deemed necessary in the operation of that, from the experience that people have with the operation of that system. And there may be, under that sort of a system, large areas areas that feel that the state should be responsible for the operation of schools. And then looking at it from that viewpoint, you've got to also address how the state ultimately does that, which is really how, at least at the legislative level, this whole business started. Local people have been screaming for 100 years to control their own futures, and their own lives, but when policymakers start fighting among themselves as to how to help people do that, that's when action finally happens. But not to any real final breakthrough at the local level to get people moving.
Any other comments on the subject?
Marshall,
I don't know. Do you have any comment on the
impact of PL 874?
Or
I touched on some of this before you arrived, Byron, regarding 874 and the implications for full state funding.
One of the and I say here is that we've looked in my department at the issue of federal impact funding. And have come also to the development of a view that we feel somewhat strongly about, and that is letting the federal requirements for funding dictate the ultimate state policy in such a sensitive area. And the whole basic issue of impact funding, Marshall, is an administrative one anyway, in terms of how decisions are made, isn't it? No? And it isn't anything in the statute or any
impact,
regulation.
Impact funding is one of the more flexible sources of federal dollars that we have as far as how it is used. It's pretty much for exclusively for operational costs, and there are very few strings attached to it. It's really one of the better systems of funding. The problem, of course, is balancing the total fiscal demands on the state as far as what it needs when 100% comes into the state, for the state then to provide the service, or when they move toward the local independent status, full amount of state general fund going out to support, with the 874 coming on top at 50% going to the local district, with nothing going into the state general fund for that. That's the thing that has to be balanced. That's